we ended last time talking about strict complementarity, the fact that in DNA, A and T always go together, C and G always go together. And it's that strict complementarity that allows for DNA to be able to self-replicate. And, you know, once we learned this, a major question was, what is the mechanism by which this happens? And there are three possibilities represented here in slide 10. One of them must be true, because these are just mathematically exhaustive. There is the so-called conservative model, the semi-conservative model, and the dispersive model. The conservative model is named for the fact that the original DNA, which is represented by dark blue, is conserved in each generation in one of the cells. That's why it's both strands are blue in the next generation for one of the cells, and then both strands are blue again. So completely new material, both strands, is what's produced if the conservative model is true. The semi-conservative model is half conservative, meaning that in each generation, one of the two strands is old material, one of the strands is new material, dark blue, light blue, as you see here. And then the only other possibility is the so-called dispersive model, which is also the most complex. It basically says that the original DNA gets broken into pieces, and then new pieces are made, and then pieces are joined back together. So each of the two strands is partially old material, partially new material, as you see here. Well, all of those could result in DNA being replicated. So the question is, which of these is true? And, of course, the way to figure that out is to set up a proper experiment to test those. That's what's shown in slide 11. So this uses labeling again, but not radioactive isotopes. Instead, a heavy isotope of nitrogen, meaning its normal nitrogen is N14, or the most commonly encountered nitrogen version is N14. The isotope that has an additional neutron is N15, and because it has that additional neutron, it's slightly more massive than a normal normal nitrogen. And therefore, that was used to label the DNA. There's nitrogen in all nitrogenous bases, so all DNA nucleotides have nitrogen in them. And if you force the heavy nitrogen to be used, then you can keep track of where it is, not by detecting radiation, but by using centrifugation. Because in centrifugation, the heavier things drop to the bottom. It separates them out based on their mass. So what they did was allow for a generation to occur. In other words, for one generation of new DNA to be built out of this material. And then they centrifuged it. And then they looked at what they found in the centrifuge tube. Well, if the conservative model is true, then you should see two two places in the tube where you find the nitrogen. You should have a lighter band up here and a darker band down here, because the darker band is heavier. It's completely old material, and this is completely new material. Whereas if you have either the conservative model or the dispersive model, you'd only have one band, right? Because in either of these two scenarios, a DNA is half old and half new, just in different ways. You following what I'm saying here? And notice the red X. They did not see two bands. So right away, they proved that the conservative model is not true. But they couldn't tell, since it has the same results for both, same predictions for both, which of these two is true. So they had to do another generation of DNA replication and then centrifuge it again. And notice that the dispersive model would predict for there to be one band again in the second generation, it'd just be a little lighter because now it would be 3/4 new material and 1/4 old material. Whereas the conservative model on the second generation would predict two bands, because some of it is totally new, some of it is half old and half new, just like agrees with the previous slide. Right, the second generation in the semi-conservative model is going to be light blue and light blue, because one of those light blues came from this one. And so that's exactly what they found. In the second generation, you have two centrifugation bands, and it's a pretty good, and this is another well-designed experiment to demonstrate which of the three possibilities is actually true. So those were all three possibilities, but what is actually true for DNA replication is the semi-conservative model, which means that each DNA is made up of one strand that is from the previous generation, and one strand has brand new information, brand new DNA nucleotides. Okay, so that's out of the way. We realize that that DNA replicates semi-conservatively. Now we need to look at the details of how that DNA replication occurs. And there is a dichotomy of cell types that we always talk about, right? Any given cell is either prokaryotic or eukaryotic. They both have DNA, of course, but I've already mentioned that there is a difference in these two cells with respect to how the DNA is arranged, specifically what the chromosomes are like, right? Do you remember me talking about this? In a prokaryotic cell, there is just one chromosome, typically, whereas in a eukaryotic cell, there are multiple chromosomes, and the number depends on the species. Also, a prokaryotic chromosome is circular, so it doesn't have any ends. It's just a loop. Whereas eukaryotic chromosomes, however many there are, depending on the species, are linear chromosomes, meaning they have two ends. They don't loop back around. So that is a difference, but it doesn't really make very much difference with respect to how the DNA is replicated. So you see replication happening in a prokaryotic chromosome, circular chromosome above, and eukaryotic chromosome below. There are slight differences, but much of it is the same. Looking at the top one, the prokaryotic cell, though, notice that this is a single circular chromosome made up of two strands. So it's once again, dark blue represents the original DNA, and light blue will represent new DNA. Now, really, even though it's a circular chromosome, it still is double helical. So those two dark strands would actually wrap around each other as they go around the circle. Just for simplicity, they drew it as two single circles like that. That's not really how it would be. But it would be a mess to look at if they drew it how it actually is. Okay, anyway, in a circular chromosome, there is no end, of course. But replication doesn't start just anywhere on the circle. There is actually a particular point along that circle where replication begins. And that place is called, descriptively enough, the origin of replication, represented by the two black dots, one for each of the two strands. So, in other words, the set of proteins that I'm going to talk about that are involved in getting this replication done recognize a specific place on the circular chromosome to start the process. And just like I was talking about last time, in order to actually do either of the two major jobs of DNA, transcription or replication, and right now we're looking at replication, you have to read the code, and in order to do that, read the sequence, you have to separate the two strands. So, at the origin of replication, the two strands start to be separated from each other, which is easy to do because they are only hydrogen bonds holding them together, right? That's what's important about that. And that forms this kind of football-shaped opening called a replication bubble. And so that football-shaped replication bubble has two ends, the two points of the football, called replication forks. All right, that opens it up, exposing both individual strands. Because we're not going to just replicate one strand, we're going to replicate both. And each original strand, dark blue strand, is going to serve as the code using complementarity rules for how to build a copy out of new material of the other strand. And that's happening on both of the two original strands. Well, you can see that right here as new light blue DNA is laid down next to each original dark blue strand. All right, that's the replication. And as time goes, the replication bubble gets bigger and bigger because each of the two ends, the replication forks, keep opening up more and more, separating more and more of the strands, or separating more and more distance of the two strands. All right? And as more and more original strands material gets exposed, new material gets laid down. Eventually, the replication fork will come back all the way to the other end of the circle, and at that point, you have two double-stranded DNAs, two complete chromosomes that are identical to each other and that are identical to the original one, but the two that you have at the end of this process are made up of one strand of totally original material, dark blue, and one strand of totally new material, light blue. That's the semi-conservative nature of it. Okay? You can see that happening in, you can see this replication bubble forming with two replication forks in the photomicrograph. Okay, we'll look at the molecular particulars of this in a little bit, but that's an overview of what's happening. Now, the eukaryotic chromosomes are not circular, they are linear. So they do have two ends. And one difference corresponding to this, that as far as replication is concerned, is that it's not just one replication bubble that forms for a eukaryotic chromosome. It's multiple. Also, keep in mind that however many chromosomes there are, the same thing is happening in each chromosome. Just one chromosome is shown here, but there would be some number of chromosomes at which the same thing is happening. But if you think about this, you have a linear chromosome with two ends. You could just start in the middle and make a replication bubble that would get bigger and bigger until it finally got to the ends. That would work, but it would take more time than what actually occurs. Instead of having just one replication bubble, there are multiple origins of replication, each of which creates a bubble spaced apart from each other. And so you have multiple bubbles that each get bigger, but they only have to grow until they meet the next bubble that way, if they're all simultaneously being built. And that way you get done with the whole thing in much shorter time than if you have one bubble that has to get all the way to the ends. Other than that, though, what's happening in each bubble is really the same as what happens in a prokaryotic cell. Separation of the strands allows for the reading of the code, and then complementarity rules are used to lay down new material that's complementary to the original material for each strand. And by the time you're done with that, once again, you have two double-stranded chromosomes identical to each other and identical to the original one, and each one is half material, one strand is half material. Old material, one strand is new material. All right, now let's study this as far as the individual kinds of molecules involved. This is slide 13. And so real close-up view, the dark blue here is just a part of the overall length of the chromosome. And dark blue is all original material here. We're so close up that we're not even seeing an entire replication bubble here. It's already opened up, so a replication bubble has already formed. But we're looking at just one end of it. This is one replication for it, one point of the football. The other one is off screen to the right. And the same stuff that's happening here is also happening on the other half of the replication bubble. But there are several different proteins involved in this DNA replication process that we need to individually study the functions of. All but one of these proteins are not only proteins, but they function as enzymes. All right? First one I'll talk about is the pink one. Oh, I'm sorry. No, the green one, which is helicase. Helicase, of course, is an enzyme. That's why it's called helicase. It's named for the fact that it's working on the DNA double helix. But its job is to recognize the origin of replication, which is a specific sequence in the overall DNA sequence. Those black dots on the previous slide are actually nucleotide sequences that get recognized by helicase. And helicase breaks those hydrogen bonds between the two strands at the origin of replication to start the replication bubble. All right? Now, as it does that, helicase starts to move down the length of the strand. One strand is separated from the other, and helicase will move down that strand, unzipping as it goes. Now, if you didn't have any other thing operating here, any other kind of protein, then as soon as helicase, unlike a real zipper on a bag, which stays unzipped, as soon as helicase moved away and started unzipping down here, these two pieces will go right back together, right? Because of the reason they were together to begin with. They are complementary to each other, and they want to form those hydrogen bonds. So helicase has to separate those strands, but since it's going to move out of the way, you need another protein to temporarily keep these things clamped apart so that the other proteins we're going to talk about can then do their job. And those proteins are not acting as enzymes. They are called single-strand binding proteins, the gray ones here. They clamp on to a strand after it's been separated by helicase, and that keeps them from going back together for the moment. And single-strand binding protein will basically follow helicase as it moves down the length. But by keeping the two strands from sealing back together, then the third protein in this picture can do its job, and that was the pink one called primase. Primase is an enzyme that gets its name from the fact that its job is to lay down what is called an RNA primer. An RNA primer is a short sequence of nucleotides, but they are RNA nucleotides. That's the red piece right here. Now think about what the goal is here, so to speak. The goal is to produce a new DNA strand, right? So why in the world would you involve RNA, which is not the same kind of nucleic acid? Well, the simple answer is that you have no choice, really. And that's because cells don't have the ability to lay down a DNA nucleotide unless there's already a nucleotide there that it can add that DNA nucleotide to. Whereas RNA can be put down onto nothing. It can be the first nucleotide laid down. DNA can't. So you have to start with RNA simply because that's the way things are chemically. And then once you have this RNA primer, then you can start adding DNA nucleotides to the end of that to make it longer. All right? And that hasn't happened in this picture yet, but it will. But primase's job is to lay down the primer so that you have something to build on to add DNA nucleotides to, in other words. Here's where it becomes important to recall what I've said about the directionality of the strands. Any individual strand of nucleic acid, no matter how short or long it is, has a 3' end and a 5' end. We talked about that last time. The reason it's so important here is because no kind of nucleotide, either RNA or DNA, can be added to the 5' end of a growing strand. Only to the 3' end. So as DNA, or as nucleic acids, including DNA, get built, they get longer and longer in the 3' end. New nucleotides are added to the 3' end, not to the 5' end. So notice, even though an RNA primer is really short, it still has a 5' end and a 3' end. And notice that the 3' end has the arrow going away from it. That's showing you that new nucleotides can be added one at a time to this end, but not to the 5' end. All right? So that's three of the major protein players. Oh, no, there's another one shown here. I forgot. Topoisomerase in blue here is important as well. It's also an enzyme, but you have to picture what this would be like when you unzip the double helix. The double helix is kind of like a simple rope. Most ropes have several strands, but just think of a rope that has two strands coiled. If you try to separate those, let's just attach the rope one end to the wall, and you try to separate the two strands, you can do that for a while, right? But what happens to the rest of the rope is it gets tighter and tighter, gets more tightly coiled, if you continue to separate it. And that eventually becomes a problem. You eventually will not be able to separate it anymore because of how tightly coiled it gets. So topoisomerase job is to travel down the length of the DNA ahead of the opening fork, and every now and then make a cut in the DNA and more or less allow it to flop around, relieve its tension, and then seal it back together so that you don't have this problem of overcoiling. All right, that's now, just like I said earlier, the same exact thing is happening to the other end of the replication fork, which has the same problem. So there's topoisomerase over here as well. Okay, that's four major proteins. Now we're up 14. And this shows you a couple important things, one of which I've already showed you. Namely, that when you're building a new strand of DNA, and notice it's light blue to indicate it's new material, using the original DNA as the template, the dark blue, you can't do that in both directions. You can only add a new nucleotide to the 3' end. So it has to grow in this direction. All right? That's one important thing. The other, though, is that remember what it means to be a nucleotide. If I give you the word nucleotide, the only thing you know for sure is that you have a nitrogenous base, a sugar, and some number of phosphates, one or more, right? The word nucleotide doesn't tell you how many phosphates there are. That's why I said in an earlier chapter that it's more descriptive to call ATP, for instance, adenosine triphosphate, or more generically, a nucleoside triphosphate, than it is to call it a nucleotide, even though it is a nucleotide. Because nucleoside triphosphate tells you exactly how many phosphates there are. What is a nucleoside? What's the difference between a nucleoside and a nucleotide?
A nucleotide has the 5 sugars, the nucleic base, and the phosphate.
Doesn't a nucleoside only have one of those things?
Has two of them. A nucleoside is just the nitrogenous base and the sugar. No phosphate. Okay? So if you add a phosphate to a nucleoside, you have a nucleoside monophosphate. If you add two phosphates, you have a nucleoside diphosphate. And if you add three, you have a nucleoside triphosphate, like ATP, for instance. Okay? So a nucleoside is just the nitrogenous base and the sugar. It would be just these two blue pieces right here, light blue pieces of this one that's coming in. That alone would be the nucleoside. Now, every one of these nucleotides that are already part of the growing strand are not only nucleotides, more specifically, they are nucleoside monophosphates, right? Each nucleotide already part of the strand contains exactly one phosphate. So they're all nucleoside monophosphates in the final product. Notice, though, that what's coming in is not a nucleoside monophosphate, it's a nucleoside triphosphate. It has three phosphates, but it's going to end up needing only one phosphate to be part of the DNA. So why then don't you just use nucleoside monophosphates to begin with, rather than nucleoside triphosphates that are coming in one at a time? That's right. Nucleoside triphosphates have more energy than nucleoside monophosphates, right? You know that from ATP. ATP uses ribose as its sugar, so it wouldn't be used here. But ATP you're already familiar with as being much more energetic than ADP or AMP, right? So those extra phosphates, even though they're not going to be part of the DNA, the extra phosphates that are part of each incoming nucleoside triphosphate are a source of energy that's required for building this thing. So think about this energetically. How would you classify the building of a polynucleotide, energetically speaking? What kind of process is that? It's endergonic. You're building a big complex thing out of smaller things, right? That's never going to be free. You have to have an energy source for that. So if you brought it in as a nucleoside monophosphate, it wouldn't happen because you're not supplying any energy. You're just supplying the raw materials. By supplying a nucleoside triphosphate and then cleaving off two of those phosphates, that releases energy, some of which can be captured in order to make this bond to add one more nucleotide to the growing chain. All right, so it's the energy source. And what you see in the middle in the orange box is that, like all reactions in biology, this is catalyzed by its own enzyme. So this is another protein that's a major player in the game. It's called DNA polymerase, named for the fact that it catalyzes the polymerization, or the building of a polymer, specifically the DNA polynucleotide. All right, so DNA polymerase is the enzyme. You could tell that even without its name ending in ASE. Why do you know this is an enzyme? Right, it's not on either end of the arrow as reactants and products are. It's above, so it shows you that it's an enzyme. But DNA polymerase helps this out, and it allows for the cleavage of two of those phosphates. So this is the phosphate-phosphate bond that's broken. Instead of cleaving off just one, like you did in ATP to make ADP, you cleave off two. That leaves just a nucleoside monophosphate, which is what gets incorporated into the chain. But two of those phosphates still hooked together are what are removed. That's what's shown here with the two P's still hooked. That is called pyrophosphate. When it's two inorganic phosphates hooked together still, called pyrophosphate. That doesn't last long, though, because eventually the pyrophosphate will break into two individual inorganic phosphates and become just part of the phosphate pool that's always there. Yeah?
Can you go over the part where the nucleoside and the nucleotide?
Yeah, a nucleoside is simply these two parts of the three parts of a nucleotide. A nucleoside is just the nitrogenous base and the sugar without any phosphate. Okay, so if this didn't have anything on it, it would simply be a nucleoside. But when you have a phosphate on it, some number of phosphates, it's not only a nucleotide, because a nucleotide simply means it's a nucleoside with one or more phosphates. You can specify how many phosphates there are by calling it either a nucleoside monophosphate, a nucleoside diphosphate, or a nucleoside triphosphate. This is a nucleoside triphosphate that's coming in. And even though you don't need those extra two phosphates to be incorporated into the DNA, you need them to provide the energy for making this a little bit longer molecule, which is an endergonic process. And that's all catalyzed by DNA polymerase. Only at the 3' end. 5' end, you can't do that with. Okay. Let's then go to 15. Now on the top, kind of tan background box, you have one whole replication fork, as you see. But one replication fork features 4 strands of new material. The upper left in this box is the same as the lower right. Those are called the so-called leading strands. And then the other diagonal, lower left on this figure and upper right, are the so-called lagging strands. And new DNA is being built in all of these cases, but the difference is that the leading strands get built in one piece that just gets longer and longer. The reason that is true is because the leading strand has its 5 prime, the direction it's growing in, oriented in the same direction that the fork is opening. So as the fork opens more and more, it just allows for longer and longer leading strand to be built. Same thing over here. All right, and that's because the original DNA strand, the dark blue, has its own directionality. Therefore, the new strand has anti-parallel directionality, right? So this 3' original DNA corresponds to the 5' new DNA, and therefore this end where it's opening up for the new strand is the 3' end. That's where you can add to them. Am I losing anyone? Yeah, now you have to think about the directionality. This upper original DNA strand is 5' on the left, 3' on the right. Because of anti-parallel rules, the new strand that's being built next to it is opposite. It's 5' on the right, 3' on the left. Okay, this is the 3' end. And this fork, this particular fork, is opening up more and more to the left, which is the 3' direction. So that's the correct, this leading strand is in the correct orientation to just keep growing as it opens more and more. That's why it's called the leading strand. Same exact thing is happening on the other end of the replication bubble, but on the other strand. Because this other strand, the original DNA, is 5' on the right here, and the new strand is therefore 3' on the right. But this fork is opening up toward the right, so it's once again opening up in the direction of the growth of the leading strand. So it's easier, in other words, to do the leading to build the leading strand, and that's why it is the leading strand. It happens quicker. As soon as it opens up, gives it room to grow, because it has to be growing in that direction. On the other hand, the other two diagonals are called the lagging strands because the direction that the fork is opening up is opposite to the direction that the new strand has to grow. All right? That's going to happen here on this bottom strand. Notice the bottom strand is 3 prime on the left, 5 prime on the right. Therefore, the strand of new material is going to be opposite to that. It's going to be 5 prime to the right, to the left, sorry, and 3 prime to the right. You see that? Anti-parallel means that they're going in opposite directions. The original strand is 3 prime to the left, 5 prime to the right. The new strand, which hasn't been, it's not in this picture yet, but it's going to be built right here, is opposite of that. So it's 3 prime on the left, 3 prime on the right, 5 prime on the left. And remember, it can only grow in the 3 prime direction, which is toward the right in this figure. But the fork is opening up to the left. So it's opening up behind it, not in front of it, in terms of how the directions it has to grow. Does that make it more clear? Notice the arrows here on the upper figure. The lagging strand has to grow in the direction that's opposite the direction the fork is opening up into. This left fork is opening up toward the left, but the lagging strand has to be built toward the right because that's the direction the 3 prime is in. On the right fork, the fork is opening up to the right, but the lagging strand has to grow toward the left because that's where the 3 prime end is situated on that strand. And therefore, the lagging strand cannot be made in just one piece. The lagging strand has to be built piecewise, just a little bit at a time. And each new piece has to feature its own red, in this figure, RNA primer. As soon as the fork opens up enough for you to be able to lay down a primer, that's laid down. And then the 3 prime end of that is where you extend the length with DNA nucleotides. But that's in the opposite direction compared to how this thing's opening up. So if it opens up some more, then you lay down a new primer here and grow it up until you reach the previous piece. And so on. That make it more clear? That's why those are called the lagging strands. They have to be built a little piece at a time, growing in the direction opposite the direction of opening of the fork. Okay, now, DNA polymerase, there are actually multiple DNA polymerases. The one that's responsible for extending the length of the strand, whether it's leading or lagging, by adding new DNA nucleotides to the 3 prime end of the growing strand, that is specifically DNA polymerase 3, which is why it's labeled here that way. It's not just DNA polymerase, it's specifically DNA polymerase 3 that does that job. So it's the orange one in this figure. You can see that helicase is opening the fork more and more, and the single-strand binding proteins are keeping them from going right back together, so these things can get their job done. Primase has already done its job, so primase isn't shown here, but you can see that it's worked because you have an RNA primer that was put in place, and that was the job of RNA of primase. Okay. The bottom is the leading strand being built. We don't see the lagging strand being built in this figure, but it needs to be piecewise. That's what's clarified in 16. This is really no different from the top of the previous slide, but it shows it in closer detail and it gives you numbers. So number one here was the first piece of the lagging strand to be built. And that was when the fork was just barely opened up there. When it opened up enough for you to put a primer down, and then you could extend it by DNA polymerase 3 adding DNA nucleotides, that's how this fragment was built. Then the fork opened up more and allowed room for another primer to be laid down so that you can then extend it toward the right again until you run into that previous fragment. And so on. The lagging strand has to be built in fragments, and those fragments are called Okazaki fragments. Another eponym. Whereas the leading strand is just one piece, the lagging strands are made of several Okazaki fragments. 17 shows this again. Slide 17 shows you primase, the pink one, laying down an RNA primer to begin with. All right? The primer has a 3' end toward the right in this picture. And then DNA polymerase 3, the orange one here, comes along and adds one at a time new DNA nucleotides to the 3' end. Can only grow in the 3' direction. All right? The fork here, not shown, is opening up toward the left. So when you have enough exposed, then you add another RNA primer and grow it toward the right until you run into the previous fragment. So these are the Okazaki fragments. Each Okazaki fragment features its own RNA primer, because you have to lay down something first, and that has to be RNA. Okay, now, once you get all the Okazaki fragments made, you have filled up all the space, basically, right? You have as many nucleotides as you need. But there's a couple problems remaining. One is that even though there are enough nucleotides, they're not all DNA nucleotides, right? All of the primers are made out of RNA nucleotides. Well, they can't be allowed to be in the final product. The final product has to be pure DNA. So you had to use the RNA primers, otherwise you couldn't build it, but now you need to get rid of them after all the nucleotides have been laid down. And that involves yet another enzyme. And that is shown by the yellow one. Its name, not listed here, is DNA polymerase 1. So it's a different version of DNA polymerase. What DNA polymerase 1 does is go down the length of the new strand and recognize the RNA molecule, RNA nucleotides that are there, take them out and replace them with the correct version of DNA nucleotides. All right, that solves one problem, but there's still one remaining problem. After DNA polymerase 1's job is done, then you have all the nucleotides and they're all DNA nucleotides. But the problem is DNA polymerase 1 is not able to sew together end to end the fragments. Notice that little space there. The nucleotides are in place, but they're not all connected by phosphodiester bonds yet, making up a complete sugar phosphate backbone. There's little nicks in them, so there's still fragments that need to be sewn together end to end. And that is the job of the final protein we're going to look at in this process, represented here by this tealish or blue color. And that enzyme is called ligase, or DNA ligase. Now notice that word. It's an enzyme, obviously, but it's named that because it ligates, or ties together, binds together, the Okazaki fragments. And once DNA ligase's job is done, then you have a complete new strand. One continuous strand, the whole length of the chromosome, made up of entirely new material, light blue in this color scheme. Well, let's review it in slide 18, which is kind of a catch-all picture. Once again, shows you just one half of a replication bubble. The same thing's happening on the other replication bubble, except the leading strand that is shown on the upper left here will be on the lower right there, and similarly for the lagging strand. The two lagging strands are diagonal to each other as well. But what has already occurred by the time we see this cartoon is that helicase came along and recognized an origin of replication when the two DNA strands were still sealed together and separated them at that origin of replication and then moved down. Now you really have two helicases working, one on each end of the replication bubble, and they're moving in opposite directions, unzipping as they go to prevent those two strands from just going right back together. As soon as helicase passes, these single strand binding proteins clamp on temporarily and allow then RNA primase, or just primase, the pink one, to lay down primers. Now, a primase laid down one primer for the leading strand, and that's the only primer that you need for that leading strand. But primase is going to have to put down a separate primer for each Okazaki fragment in the lagging strand. Right, that's the pink primase. Once the primers are in place, the 3' end of each primer is where you can add new DNA nucleotides. And that's where DNA polymerase 3 does its job. Keeps adding them one at a time, just continuously for the leading strand. But for the lagging strand, DNA polymerase 3, another orange one, is adding to the primer of an Okazaki fragment until it runs into the previous Okazaki fragment. Okay, then you have enough nucleotides down, but you have to get rid of the RNA nucleotides. So that is taken care of by DNA polymerase 1. It removes the RNA nucleotides of the primers and replaces them with the appropriate DNA nucleotides. And then the final job is to sew all the fragments together to seal these nicks, in other words, to make those final phosphodiester bonds, and that job is DNA ligases. Questions about the process? Yeah.
So when the leading strand, that's the, depending on the direction of the replication process, that's going to be the 5' on the way that it's growing, or is that going to be the 3'?
No matter what strand it is, leading or lagging, It's growing only. It can only grow in the 3' direction.
Right.
But the reason that this is the leading strand is because its 3' end, which is its left end on this one, is the direction that the fork is opening up into. So you unzip this more and more, you just leave more room for more growth in the 3' direction.
Okay.
But the lagging strands have to be built in the opposite direction because their 3' end is toward the right, which is, you know, the other direction. When you open this up, you're opening up behind it in the 5' direction, not in the 3' direction. It still has to grow this way, though, because it has to grow in the 3' direction. So that's why you have to just wait until you have enough open, put a new primer down, and then grow this way until you run into the previous one.
Well, how does it determine that that's the 5' direction?
Because it has to be anti-parallel to the template strand of DNA, the original dark blue DNA. This one on the bottom is 3' over here. Therefore, the new strand, to be anti-parallel, has to be 3' to the right, not to the left. This one's also anti-parallel. The original DNA is 5' to the left. Therefore, the new strand is 3' to the left. That's appropriate.
Because it's the newer one, it's going to be the opposite of the top one.
Yes.
Okay.
Any two strands that are together, whether it's two original or an original and a new, have to be anti-parallel.
Right. So
That's why.
Okay.
Is that clear to everyone else? All right. That's the basics of DNA replication. And what's amazing is that very few errors are made. I mean, when you compare it to a macroscopic process, you know, like an industrial process, like mail or any industry, to have an error rate of only 1 per million times you do something is astonishingly low. You know, no real company does that. A million is a hell of a lot. Well, when you think about it, a chromosome, just one chromosome, is millions of nucleotides. So even if you had an error rate of only 1 in a million, you would still definitely be making mistakes every time you replicate just one chromosome, and there are many chromosomes within a cell of a eukaryotic cell. So you have to have a very low error rate, and all of this machinery I've been talking about works really well most of the time, but not perfectly. There are mistakes that get made. So first of all, it's a low error rate to begin with. Impressive enough. But there's also, to make it even lower, cells have what is called proofreading capability. So they're able to check their work and recognize most of the errors that are made and correct them. So it ends up being a very low rate of error. Now that's during the replication process. And there also are repair techniques that can be used even after replication. But what we see here is one defect that can develop. Notice the little bump in the top piece of double-stranded DNA. That little bulge is called a dimer, and it happens between two adjacent thymines. Remember that the code within one strand can be anything. So you can have two T's next to each other. It's just that happens. That can happen, no problem. But remember that within one strand, adjacent nucleotides are not supposed to be connected to each other. Or adjacent nitrogenous bases are not connected to each other, right? They're just hanging off of the backbone. When you have two thymines, it can be especially prone to those two adjacent thymines, which are not supposed to be connected to each other on the same strand, to form a dimer, a covalent bond between them. And that's called a thymine-thymine dimer. This is what can easily happen with ultraviolet radiation from sunlight. You know, this is one reason why it causes cancer. It causes defects in the DNA. And that's what's happened here. That black line between these two pieces is a covalent bond that shouldn't be there between adjacent nitrogenous bases. So the part of the proofreading mechanism I'm talking about, it works in different ways, but part of that is to recognize that there is a problem like this involving an enzyme called nuclease. Well, there are multiple nucleases. That's kind of a category, really. But nucleases are enzymes that are able to recognize defective sequences of DNA and perform what is called excision repair. Excision is the noun form of excise, which means to cut out. X means out, and size, like in scissors, means cut. Excision repair means that the error will be recognized, the sequence that involves that error will be cut out, so you make two cuts, one on either end of the error itself. Those defective nucleotides are removed, and here's where complementarity is nice, because you're losing that information, right? But it's no problem because you know exactly what kind of DNA nucleotides to replace it with simply by looking at the still intact other strand. And that's what nuclease does. Removes these, or I'm sorry, nuclease doesn't do that. Nuclease just removes them, but another enzyme, DNA polymerase 1 again, comes along and fills in the hole appropriately by reading the DNA sequence in this still intact strand and then uses complementarity rules to replace it. Just like when you're building new DNA, though, the DNA polymerase 1 can't make that final phosphodiester bond, so you still, in this, for the same reason, need DNA ligase to come along then and make that final phosphodiester bond to make it a complete strand. So with proofreading, you have really an astonishingly low level of errors. But errors do happen, and those errors are mutations. And we'll talk more about mutations in a later chapter, but that's just one example of how they happen. Also, exposure to things can, chemicals in sunlight and things can cause, could cause mutations. All right, that brings us to 20. And this involves a problem that only eukaryotic cells have. Prokaryotic cells have circular chromosomes, as we already talked about. And therefore, they don't have this problem because this problem involves the ends of chromosomes. Well, prokaryotic cells don't have any ends. It's a loop. But in a eukaryotic chromosome, there are two ends. And we're looking at just one end of the chromosome here. Of course, it has another end off screen, and it would have the same problem, only on the other strand. The problem deals with this fact that you can't put DNA down onto nothing. You can only add it to existing nucleotides, which is why you have to have an RNA primer to start with. Well, when you get to the very end, when the fork opens up all the way to the end, it's no problem to put an RNA primer down on the end because you don't need anything to put RNA down onto. That's the whole reason you need primers to begin with. Okay, so that happens normally. And then you add DNA nucleotides to the primer just as usual, no problem. Then DNA polymerase 1 comes along, and what's its job in the replication process? To take out the RNA primer, which it can do successfully. That's why it's no longer here. But then you're stuck because you can't put DNA down here. There's nothing here to the left of it to add on to fill this hole because you're out of strand if you're at the end. So when you remove the RNA primer, that's the only thing you can do. And that means that every cell cycle, every generation of cells, a eukaryotic chromosome gets a little bit shorter because you can't build it quite all the way to the end. All right? You don't have that problem with a circular chromosome, but eukaryotic cells do. Well, that's not a problem for some number of times that it happens. And that's because the genes themselves are really just subsequences of nucleotides within the overall very long sequence that we call the chromosome. Right? There's millions of A's, T's, C's, and G's in a sequence in the overall chromosome. Within that sequence, there are subsequences, and that's what genes are, corresponding to how to build messenger RNA molecules for the purpose of translating those into proteins. But between the genes are sequences as well of DNA. It's all sequence, but genes are just parts of that. And you know, if you make a DNA shorter, which you do because of this, these tips, by the way, the very ends of eukaryotic chromosomes are called telomeres. When you shorten the telomeres, which has to happen because of what I just said, that isn't a problem unless you start eating into genes. So this is beginning to be an old-fashioned analogy because of digital movies now. But when movies were still shot on film and projected as film, you know, you have reels of film that contain individual frames of the movie. The individual frames of the movie are kind of like the genes on a chromosome. And if you have a really popular movie that gets played a lot of times, they had to run it through the projector a lot of times. And so it would get worn, and it wouldn't feed through the projector properly, so they would have to snip a little piece off the end, which is kind of like the shortening of the telomeres. That's no problem, though, for the movie, because all movie reels came with a long leader for the purpose of being able to snip it off a little bit at a time, and it's no problem because you're not eating into the movie. But if you do it enough times, eventually you're going to be removing frames of the movie, right? That would be like damaging the actual genes, and therefore those genes no longer work and code for the proteins that they code for, which means the cell wouldn't be able to survive. So there's an upper limit to the number of times you can shorten the telomeres, in other words. Well, this would doom us all, right? Because eventually that would mean extinction of all eukaryotes. But obviously that has not happened. And that's because eukaryotes have evolved a way around this problem. They have a special enzyme called telomerase, obviously named for the telomeres, that whose job it is every once in a while to add just a kind of a dummy sequence onto the end that isn't there for coding for anything. It's simply there to make the leader longer so that you can then eat away at it without damaging any genes. All right, there's just a couple slides left in this chapter, 21 and 22, but they actually make up one figure. Let me show you what I mean before I talk about either one of them. They show DNA, but we're really zoomed in close on the left of 21, and then we're zooming out as we go toward the right. But the picture actually continues into 22, so you're getting more and more zoomed out as you go to the right on both of these. I think in the book it's probably just one figure. But anyway, these two slides indicate how DNA is organized within a cell. It's pretty amazing how packed, how efficiently DNA is packed into a cell, because when you think about an individual cell, that's invisibly small, right? You can't even see it. And it's amazing that the DNA is in that cell, but it's not in the entire cell, right? The DNA is only in the nucleus within that cell, which is much smaller than the cell itself. And from the S phase onward in the cell cycle, you not only have the DNA in there, you have two sets of DNA, enough for two cells. Well, if you stretched out the DNA for a human that's in just one invisible cell, it would be about a meter long. And you have to pack that into something that's not only invisibly small, but a nucleus that's even smaller within that cell. And that's done by using histone proteins, which are part of chromatin. Remember earlier I said that chromosomes are made out of chromatin, which is a mixture of DNA and proteins. Well, for each chromosome, once it is called a chromosome, there's just one DNA, a double strand, but it's one end-to-end DNA. And then there are many, many histone proteins making up the rest of the chromatin. All right, so here you just have the DNA itself. Here you have individual histones. Notice that each individual histone kind of looks like a human sperm cell, but it's a protein. A protein with a globular head and a tail. All histones are basically the same. They're just copies of each other. When you get eight of these histones complexed together with their tails radiating outward, in this figure, or in that configuration, then you have more or less what amounts to a hose reel. Those tails function kind of like a hose reel, and the globular heads are like the hub of the hose reel. And you can therefore wrap several wrappings of DNA around that. It's all one long DNA, but there are many, many hose reels that are used along the length. One hose reel, which consists of eight histones, plus whatever length of DNA is wrapped around that, is called a nucleosome. So that alone really makes DNA much more compact and organized. Just wrapping them around the nucleosome. So if that's all that happened, the chromatin would look like beads on a string. Each bead is a nucleosome, and then just naked DNA between each nucleosome would be like the string. That's not all that happens, though, as you see. Once the nucleosomes form, then they clump together into a much wider but much shorter piece. That's what you see on the right edge here. And that's supposed to blend into the left edge of slide 22. That makes it much more compact again. And then this wider piece is then looped back and forth many, many times to make this even wider structure, which is what makes up the most dense form when we finally call it a chromosome, when it appears as an individual piece. But if you look at the detail in there, you have a hell of a lot of little nucleosomes acting as hose reels around which the very long DNA is wound. And somehow the cell keeps it all straight and doesn't make very many mistakes. Pretty impressive, actually. And that's not just in one cell. Every cell in your body, every living cell except your red blood cells, has its own nucleus with all of this happening in that nucleus 100 trillion times over. So there's a lot of DNA in you. All right, that's the chapter. The question is, should I start the next one? Well, maybe the first slide.